Let's go back to Matthew chapter 24. This is what we've been doing for those of you who haven't been along with us. We're studying what's called the Olivet Discourse. It was a discussion that Jesus had with his disciples, and the context of it has to constantly be brought to our attention, because if you read any isolated passage within this text without understanding its context, you are very likely to misunderstand that text, which is true, by the way, of just about every text. So where we're going tonight, I'm not going to revisit everything we've done, but we're shifting gears now. Now we've shifted gears. Jesus was asked two questions. Go back to verse 3 of chapter 24. Now, there are two ways to put this. He was asked one question with two parts, like reporters do. I have a follow-up question. Or he was asked two questions. So whichever way you go about it, he gives two answers. So it's important to understand that he is directly answering a question or questions here. They ask him, "Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the close of the age?" That's two questions. Even the second question has two components in it. What Jesus does is he undertakes answering the latter question first. And everything that we read from verse 4 all the way down through where we are tonight, the end of verse 35 is answering that second question. What will be the sign? And the sign, it builds up. It begins. It begins in a slow method. And it builds to a crescendo. It's like birth pains. And that's he describes it as that, the pains of labor. And like the pains of labor, they become more frequent and more intense the closer you get to the delivery, to the arrival of the birth of the child. And so this is the answer to the second question. All of these details that we have read up to this point, the intensifying persecution that is going to come upon these disciples or whomever is around, and speaking of that we've already addressed what generation that will be. We don't know what generation it will be. What we do know is that whatever generation it is, once those signs begin to appear, that generation will see it all the way to the end. So it's not an eternal duration. It is not the lifetime of the church. It is one generation. We'll see it from beginning to end. And as we've read elsewhere in prophecy, this period that is being described here is a period that spans 7 years. And it makes up what Daniel called the 70th week of Daniel. And that seventh week, made up of 7 days, is divided into two halves in the book of Daniel, in Daniel chapter 11. 3.5 days make up one portion of the week, and the other 3.5 days, the latter portion of the week. And that latter portion of the week is the most intense period of this tribulation, and it is what is specifically called the Great Tribulation. Now, all of it, all 7 days or all 7 years, are the tribulation, but the intense tribulation, the last 3.5 years. So that was his answer to the first or to the second question. What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? And it's important for us to understand that, because they saw that as one event, his coming and the end of the age. And in fact, they were dead right about that. His coming would be the mark of the end of the age. And so the answer to the question, what's the sign? Well, the sign was him. It will be me. You'll see me. And anyway, which is found in verse 30. Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. Now, move down to verse 36, because here he takes up the first question, and he makes it clear that that's what he's doing. But, he says, by the way, let me pause for a moment. I've given you an outline, a one-page outline. Now, I'm going to tell you why I'm doing this. I'm going to stop pretending that I know how far I'm going to get. I prepare these things, I hand them out, I get halfway through them, if that, sometimes. So I've given you what I think will be the next three studies on one piece of paper. So, it's really this text, which goes from verse 36 through verse 51. It's this text, and this text in general can be divided the way I have it there for you, but we're going to look at them one division at a time. And so, the title of this text, my title for this text is, You've Been Warned. You've been warned. You ever heard that? Have you ever said that? Parents, have you ever said that? Has a highway patrolman ever said that to you in so many words? You didn't see the speed limit? Where in Texas can you go 95 miles an hour legally? Well, not that I've ever heard that. Yeah, well, I don't think it's even legal then, but get out of my way, I'm going. All right, so here's what we're going to do. I'm going to treat this simply, somewhat exegetically. We're just going to go through it somewhat phrase by phrase, and we're going to look at each of these divisions one at a time and break them down for our understanding, because what Jesus does here in transition, when he transitions at verse 36 and begins to say, but concerning the day and hour, you see he's addressing the time question, the when question. He does that all the way through verse 40 of chapter 25. He does just that. He answers that question. He gave a lot of attention to the second question that he was asked. Now he's going to give equal and even more time to the first question. But we're going to see in this, the way he answers these questions, the question is not for him. The importance of the question is somewhat put back on the audience. You're asking about when, but let me tell you what you need to know. I can't tell you what you can't know. Furthermore, as we're going to see, he says, I can't tell you what I don't know. But I can tell you what you do need to know about the time. And these three divisions that I have here are his answers to that question. And the first answer is, be ready. Be ready. When is it coming? Be ready. But concerning that day and hour, no one knows. Not even the angels of heaven. Now that's an important phrase, because this term for angel here is describing the beings that serve God. They surround God, they are around Him at the throne, they are as intimate with Him as created beings can be. They don't even know that He hasn't made it privy to them. He hasn't revealed it even to those angels who are gathered around Him in close proximity. They don't know, these angels of heaven, they don't know. But look at this next phrase. Now, how many of you have a King James translation with you tonight? Anybody? Raise your hand. Don't be ashamed. I'm not. your text reads, what? It doesn't say anything about nor the Son, does it? Brandy, do you have a King James? It doesn't say anything about nor the Son, does it? In verse 36. It just goes, but the Father. No one knows but the Father. But the New American Standard Bible, the NIV, the New International Version, the ESV, which I use, they use what I'm going to call better manuscripts, older manuscripts. And you'll even notice in some footnotes in those translations where it says some manuscripts don't have this phrase. You see that? Well, should it be there or should it not be there? The answer is, on a textual basis, it should be there. But if you have the King James Bible and that's your Bible and you don't know how to cope with this, rest easy. There's a parallel passage in Mark chapter 13, and it has, but the Son, not even the Son of Man knows. And there's no textual discrepancy. So this parallel passage of the same discourse in Mark, in Mark's gospel, contains this phrase. So even though it's not here in some translations, these would be the older translations published before the finding of newer manuscripts, or older manuscripts, not newer, but newer to us, but older in their antiquity. Vaticanus and Sinaiticus are those manuscripts in particular. And anyway, P46, if anybody wants to know specifically what manuscript. So the point is, not even the Son knows. Now, that may create for you some kind of theological paradox. And it should. It should raise the question, how could the Son not know something? Wasn't the Son of God God? And isn't God omniscient? That phrase means knows everything. And the answer to that is, of course. He was not partly God and partly man. He was not some of God. He was all God. Every aspect of God's nature he had, he possessed while on this earth. Now, we do know, however, that he voluntarily limited his use or his access to that knowledge. Find that in passages like Philippians chapter 3 or chapter 2. It's the passage where it describes Jesus humbling himself and taking upon himself the form of a servant. It's called the kenosis passage. It means the emptying out. And he humbled himself, made himself in the form of a servant, and thought it not robbery, the King James Version says, but it means thought it not something to grasp or to hold on to. So it was as if all the access to the power and knowledge of his deity was there. He simply didn't access it. He didn't grab it. Way back in Luke's Gospel, chapter 2, the scripture describes the growth of this Messiah. And it says he grew in wisdom and stature. Now, how would that be possible if he had always accessed omniscience? Would not be possible. There'd be no growth to be seen in his wisdom. So this is completely within the realm of New Testament and Old Testament theology. It fits precisely with the humiliation of the incarnation. When God became flesh, deity itself was humiliated. It came down. He didn't cease to be God. He ceased voluntarily to access, to appropriate his divinity and even his divinity in knowledge. We know that he grew, and we know that he did have access to that knowledge, because as an adult, there are texts where the Bible says that no one had to tell him about things because he knew the heart of man. He knew what was going on. We read in passages where he knew what they were thinking. Now, you know, you and I can, we can judge by a situation. We can look at a scene and we can think we know what somebody is thinking and saying, and then we can totally embarrass ourselves because we act on that presumption of knowledge and we find out we were wrong. That's fun all the time when that embarrassment happens. But when Jesus accessed divine knowledge, he was never wrong. There were times when he even answered the questions they had in their heart and they had not voiced. He answered them. So this falls in line with that divine humiliation. And, well, let's go on. I beat that dead horse. Nobody knows but who? But the Father. The Father. And then verse 37. Now, verse 37 is an interesting verse. It has two words that are key here. Any English teachers in the room? There's one back there. I see you. Listen. There are phrases, both in our language and in the Greek language, that we use, but we're not really sure what we don't even notice that something just happened there. I want to see if you notice this, and it's okay if you don't, but I'm going to see if you notice it. Verse 37. As were the days of Noah, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Anybody notice what happened there? I want you to see two tiny words. I want you to see the word so and the word as. Now, this is called a protasis of comparison. The first word that you see, as, is the Greek word soper, translated there correctly, as. It's a historical reference. And so it points backwards. So that word is called a protasis, before. And then when you get to the middle of the verse, you see a comma, and then you see the word so. And that word is the word huda, translated here, so. And in this case, because it counters the word as, it's known as a protasis. It is a reference to the future, a time to come. And this use was an idiomatic term, an idiomatic use in the language of the New Testament. It's a term of comparison. It's a similarity. Let me be more specific, and this is where it will hit the English teachers. It's a simile. What is a simile? Huh? A comparison using the word like or as. Isn't that interesting? This is an idiom in both English and Greek. But we would just overlook it because we're reading. But he's making a comparison here. He's giving us an analogy by something historical in reference to something that hasn't happened yet. And he elaborates on it. In fact, a lot of the rest of the text we're going to look at is an elaboration on that comparison, that similarity. So he says, as were the days of Noah, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Now, stop right there. If he didn't go any further, just give me some indications. Give me some examples of the days of Noah. Disobedient, wicked. Nobody believed Noah. Think about what Noah was. Noah was a preacher. The Bible calls him a preacher of righteousness. And he was called away from his ministry or his job as a preacher of righteousness. Nobody was listening to him. So God said, build an ark. Now, that's not found until verse 38. For in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day when Noah entered the ark. Then in verse 39, it goes on and describes the flood that came. But that word, ark, we immediately think of Noah's boat, don't we? That's not what the word means. It has nothing to do with a boat. There'd never been a boat, folks. There'd never been a boat. Who knew what a boat was? This word ark means box. It means box. It's precisely what the Ark of the Covenant was. It was a box. I want you to build a box. It wasn't like God was saying, I want you to build a maritime vessel. I want it to be. He wouldn't have understood that. He understood box. Kubotos is the word. I wonder if Kubota. No, I guess not. Kubotos means box. So let's look back at the comparison. Come on, some more comparisons. What was it like around the day of Noah? In the days of Noah. Well, we know that because we read the next verse. Just think about the days of Noah, though. What was going on that made the days of Noah significant and part of history, part of the Bible? It was all this rebellion. It was all this evil. It was all this wickedness. And God had had it. He was going to judge this earth. And because Noah himself had been righteous and a preacher of righteousness, he was going to save Noah by this box. But he was not going to save anyone that wasn't in the box, right? Now, during that 120 years that Noah was building this box, he's still preaching. What in the world are you talking about? You're building a box. That's a big box. Why are you building that box? Well, because it's going to rain. It's going to what? What are you talking about? It's going to rain. It's going to come a flood. People are going to drown. Makes no sense. Nobody believed it. Well, I guess divine providence, Noah's effectiveness went no further than his own children. His wife, his three children, and their wives. So those eight people make it into this box, this comes out that this box is going to become a boat. And God shuts the door. I had to go back and read the story of Noah, by the way. God shuts the door. And the rain comes. Does God have mercy on the people that are outside the boat? God had mercy on the people outside the boat. He warned them. He warned them. He warned them. He warned them. What he warned them to do was to get ready. And they didn't. Keep that in mind. Keep that in mind. So, read on. For in those days before the flood, by the way, this word flood is a very interesting word, is the word kataklusmos. Does that sound familiar? Cataclysm. They were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day when Noah entered the ark. Now, when you read that phrase, all of a sudden this sounds sinful. These people ended up dying. And what were they doing? They weren't doing anything that you and I don't do, folks. We eat, we drink, and in the course of our lives, we give our children away in marriage. They get married. They were living their daily lives. They were going on about their business. There's a guy out there building a box that makes no sense, talking about a God who's righteous and is going to judge the world in some far out way that's never happened before. You know, I suppose they could have called the meteorologist and said, is this possible? Well, it's never happened before. No scientific proof that it's ever happened before or that it doesn't even seem to be possible. Our water comes not from above, it comes from below. This doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen. So they just go on about their business. And while it doesn't say they were doing anything sinful, folks, they were sinful. Because they were disobeying and disregarding God and His message through Noah. And why was God giving this message through Noah? Because they were sinful and they were unrighteous. And their wickedness became so unbearable for God that He determined to bring judgment on them. He would wipe out this creation and start all over with what remnant He could gather. And the remnant is 8 people in the boat. Now, how far do we go in this comparison? How far? Thankfully, Jesus didn't stop here. He went on. He guides us in this comparison. So he says in verse 39, and they were unaware until the flood, that cataclysm, came and swept them all away. Now, why were they unaware? Why? They didn't believe it. They didn't pay attention to what Noah was saying. It didn't make sense to them. It seemed ludicrous. They were carrying on. Their lives seemed normal. Nothing about their world had changed to that point. Give me some proof that this is going to happen. Well, the proof was the door shut and the rain fell. And it was too late. And it swept them all away. Verse 40. Then, that's future tense now. He's pointing now to this time in the future to which the times of Noah are being compared. So we're going to know about the times in the future by the analysis, by our looking at the times of Noah. Then two men will be in the field. By the way, some of you with Some of you with King James translations again. What? Who has the King James translation of verse 40? Anybody? King James? I know somebody did. What does verse 40 say in KJ? That's fine. Okay. And then in verse 41. Yeah. Okay. So men and women. Okay. Why men in the field and women at the mill? That was their duty. That was their job. Interesting, though, maybe only to somebody like me, Jesus uses two words for the word one. Two men will be in the field, one, and some of your translations are going to have one man will be taken, and one man left. And the reason is, that's a good translation. The reason is because there are masculine, feminine, and neuter words for one. I'm going to give you a quick Greek lesson, a vocabulary lesson. Not that you'll use it or anything, but I just think it's cute, and I've remembered it all these years. There are three genders for the word one. The first one is the Greek word heis. Heis. Transliterated, that would be E-I-S. With a rough breathing mark over the E. Heis. The second word for one is feminine, and it's the word mia. Mia. So what's the word for one? Masculine? Heis. What's the feminine word for one? Mia. It's a woman's name, I guess, isn't it? Mia. Okay. And the neuter word for the word one, it's not in this text, by the way, is the word ken. It's a rough breathing mark over an E followed by an N or epsilon nu. Ken. So heis, mia, hen. Steal me a hen. I've always remembered that. So when I'm reading through this, I'm reading through this in the original language, I come to that, I go, oh, that's why I learned that. Jesus used the words specifically, male and female. This is what the man is doing. He would be expected to be found in the field. They're working where other men work. And two will be in the field, one will be taken, and one left. Now, same with women, there are two women at the mill, one taken, one left. Now, I want you to think about this. Many people read that verse of Scripture out of context. One will be taken and one will be left. And they say, oh, that's the rapture. That's the rapture. But it's not. The rapture is nowhere in this passage. You know, I believe that there will be a rapture, but that's not the question Jesus was asked. He wasn't asked, when will you take us there? He said, when will you come? He answers the question that he was asked. When will you come? When will be the end of the age? So what's being described here? Well, go back to the analogy for the answer. Go back to the days of Noah. There were people scattered around. Noah's preaching. Nobody comes. But his family, and these animals in pairs. God shuts the door. Who was taken? Was Noah taken? Or were the wicked taken? from the earth. Who was on the earth after the flood? Where were the wicked? They were taken, weren't they? This is a picture of final judgment. This is a picture of the very end, that period at the end of the tribulation, just before Jesus comes back, sets up on this earth, finally has victory over the enemy, and establishes his kingdom upon this earth. That judgment will take the wicked from this earth. And who will be spared? The righteous who have been saved during the tribulation, they're going to be kept. Now, read on. Verse 42. Therefore, stay awake, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming. But know this, that if the master of the house had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake and would not have left his house be broken into. Therefore, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. So, you say, but I thought that all of this has been, we've got a timeline here. We've got a picture. He's given us the signs that are going along, and then they start coming closer and closer together and more intensively, and then boom, he comes. We know when he's coming because, well, the church will have been raptured and all these signs will be going on, and then he's coming. Did the people in Noah's day know what was coming? They'd been told, hadn't they? They knew what was coming. At least they had heard what was coming. But did they expect it? Were they ready for it? No. Here is a warning. And it's something we need to keep in mind. Indeed, Jesus does give us. We don't know when the church is going to be snatched away. If you believe in a rapture, which I do, we don't know when that's going to be. But equally, we do not know when the Lord is going to return. 7 years. But the day and the hour is what Jesus addresses. What day, what hour? Now let me ask you a question. If I told you what day and what hour Jesus was coming back, if I knew it, it's been said a lot of times, by the way, throughout history. People have claimed to know. People have pinpointed dates and times when Jesus was going to come back, and they've made fools out of themselves. And what kills me is they've sold a lot of books doing it. Ever tell you about the guy that wrote 87 Ways to Know Jesus is Coming Back in 87? A lot of people bought that stupid book by Ed Wisenot. I heard him interviewed on the radio, on a Christian radio station in Houston, Texas. And the guy that was interviewing him was a solid Bible scholar. And he said, Ed, give me your house. Deed your house over to me on that day. Right now. Prove that you really believe this. Oh no, and he crawfished like you've never heard. By the way, Jesus didn't come back in 1987, but get this. He wrote a book following up why Jesus, 88 reasons Jesus is coming back in 1988. It sold more than the one in 87. Anyway, how would we respond if God had posted a sign in the sky? This is the date and this is the hour. How would the world respond? Would it be more righteous? Would it be more holy? Would it be more divine? Or would it be more decadent than it already is? Knowing when He's coming, we can get in just under the line. Will there be people saved before Jesus does return? I believe that there will be. I believe that there will be people saved up to the end. I do. I believe that because of the purposes of God. One of the reasons He's not come back yet. He wants all people to repent. It's His desire that that happen. But it's not His providence. He's not making it happen. He's given us freedom. And with that freedom, we have sinned against Him and we are condemned in our sin. And those in sin, who have lived in sin, who have perpetually, continuously disregarded the gospel message, the warning about coming judgment, which, by the way, now we don't ever preach about because we are so afraid we're going to offend somebody. I'm going to tell you something. If you're driving by my house, I live over here on Della Chase. If you're driving by my house and you see flames coming out of the roof, don't worry about bothering me. Bother me. Get my attention and tell me what's going on. Let me be a fool for ignoring you. But for the most part, if we've ignored God's message through history, why would we expect it to be any different at the end? It had gotten so bad on this earth, only 8 people got into that box. As in the days of Noah, so will it be. How evil is this world now? It's hard to imagine that there could be more evil, that some imagination could take it further. But never underestimate the creativity of humanity for good and bad. Never underestimate the move of the culture. And the culture always moves away from God. The Greek word cosmos for world, as used in the New Testament, is a description of this moving away from God. For God so loved the world. A world that was moving away from Him. We think how ugly and how awful the redemption plan is. But I don't think we would consider it so awful, so gruesome, so violent if we were to compare it to the compounding sin of this world. But that's how righteous and holy the sacrifice on our part was. When Jesus died for us, His one death, His one righteous life compensated for every sin you and I have ever and will ever commit. One righteous life for all this sin. That is how rare righteousness is and how precious it is in God's sight.